through your permitting process, you are kind of figuring out how many gallons you think you're going to use, like per cow per day is kind of how you break it down. That was one of our metrics we looked at because it was an easy comparison to be able to see like, okay, because obviously different size dairies are going to use different amounts of water and it can be a drastic difference. But when you break it down per cow number, it gives you a better picture of like, oh, this dairy is doing really well, or this dairy we could use improvements or whatever. That was kind of the metric we were able to look at. And a lot of times, you know, I always joke that when we think of sustainability, we think of these big, huge projects, these multi-million dollar projects like digesters and, you know, all these things you kind of see that make the news. And from a water use standpoint, it honestly was the simplest little management changes that had the biggest impact.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Did you know that beta-carotene deficiency can affect fertility rates and reproductive performance? Victus Transition from DSM Firmenich provides beta-carotene to help your cattle fertility rates.
With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, SmaxTech future-proofs your dairy operation. Excellent, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together. Adiseo USA, producers of Smartamine M and MilkPay.com.
Lalamond Animal Nutrition, partnering in microbial solutions for a changing world.
All right, everyone, welcome to this episode of the Dairy Podcast Show. I'm your host for this week, Gail Carpenter with Iowa State University. And I'm joined today by Tara van der Dusen. Tara is a podcaster in her own right. And so she's a professional at this. She does a lot more of this than I do. She's an advocate for the dairy industry, has a background in environmental science, which is also, well, we were chatting beforehand. You're kind of you fill a really unique niche, Tara. So instead of me introducing you, do you want to kind of give what you do and a little bit about how you got where you are right now?
Yeah, it's been quite a journey. I feel like my path was not straightforward. I like think of it as, you know, you see those memes online where it's like the, you know, the bar chart that, or the graph that's just like up and down, like the lines moving up and down, and then you end up at the destination. I feel like that has been my career path. So yeah, I grew up on a dairy farm. My family's a dairy farm here in eastern New Mexico. And I went away to University of Arizona and got my degree in environmental science, ended up dating and then ultimately marrying my husband, who is also a fifth generation dairy farmer here in New Mexico. So moved back to his family farm and have been there ever since. And, you know, when I moved back to New Mexico after college, during college, I kind of thought I would go to law school. I took my LSAT, just saw myself more in that environmental law space. And when I came back, it ended up, like you said, it was a very, like, I filled a very unique niche, but like a needed niche. Here in New Mexico, I mean, as most states, you know, we have our environmental regulations. We're regulated by our state for on the dairy front. Obviously, New Mexico, we're very focused on limiting our water use. That's probably not always the case in the Midwest dairies, and just a number of different things. So I ended up becoming an environmental consultant for dairy clients throughout New Mexico, Nevada, just the Southwest, basically. It was my area of focus. And just helping those producers with their permitting and regulations, whether it be, you know, water quality, water quantity, soil health, manure management, all of that. The back end of the dairy is where I was working. And I spent more than 10 years doing that. I still do a little bit of it now. But as you alluded to, my primary focus now is actually on my podcast, Discover Ag. And the way I ended up in the podcasting realm is I started sharing on social media about, you know, dairy farming and sustainability. As we all know, there's so much misinformation about dairy farming and its impact on the environment online. And I just felt like I could really kind of like bridge that gap between consumers and have conversations with them about what it looked like, boots on the ground for dairy farms. And so I started sharing online, and it has grown and evolved and changed in so many ways and has ended up in the Discover Ag podcast space, which is a place I don't know, if you're a podcast person, you get it. I love the podcasting space.
Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together and the first ingredient in animal diets. Priority provides a more cost-effective and easier approach to nutrition. We recognize that not all bacteria are created equal. The specific strain truly matters. Priority IAC selects unique strains to provide the best performance in animals, and that's why we call these strains smart bacteria. Founded by Richard Brunig, helping to improve animal health one herd at a time.
It's a lot of fun. What drew you to environmental studies in the first place? It's kind of a lot of the kids I talk to who grew up on dairies who are looking for majors, they're going to go agronomy or dairy science or animal science or ag communications. Environmental studies isn't one of the more popular ones. So what drew you to that?
Yeah, I definitely didn't see myself ever coming back to the dairy, to be completely honest. Like classic small town kid that was like, I'm leaving and I'm never coming back. You know, I mean, the school I went to was more than 8 hours away. Like I just was in a very different like state of mind, like headspace whenever I went away to college, and didn't see myself coming back. But at the same time, there was very influential things happening, I feel like, back home in New Mexico with environmental and dairies. While I was at college, they completely rewrote our dairy regulation rule, like our permitting rules. And my dad was very involved in that process. He was a part of the dairy farmer group that would go up and talk with the regulators and try to come to agreements on what we could all like live with. You know, you were trying to write these rules that fit regulators, you know, requirements, but also made sense for dairy farmers, things that were financially feasible, you know, all these things. And so with my dad being kind of an instrumental part of that, I saw that a lot. And I remember going to a few meetings with him and I left thinking, you guys want the same thing. They want to protect groundwater. You want to protect groundwater. Like, I mean, I drink the same water as my cows, you know, like we all want to protect our natural resources, but it was like they were not speaking the same language. And so, I mean, I, at the time, you know, at 20, I didn't necessarily know I'd become an environmental consultant for dairies, but obviously it did have an influence on me that I think ultimately led me to kind of being that liaison. That's exactly what I did, was I represented my clients, you know, on behalf of my clients to the regulators, and tried to be that communication between my clients and the regulators. So it is definitely not what maybe people think of when they think of dairy farming. You know, I always tell my husband, I feel weird online when I say I'm a quote unquote dairy farmer, because I don't work with the cows. I never have. That's never been my capacity on the dairy. I've always worked in that consulting space and the environmental side. So just it's a very unique niche within dairy, but I genuinely enjoyed it. I loved working with my clients. I loved being a part of the projects they were doing on their dairy, you know, at different sustainability projects, different, you know, manure management projects. And so it was, the way it all came together was just very serendipitous.
Yeah. Can we talk about water for a little bit? It is actually, we don't deal with it as much up here in the Midwest, but it is something we do deal with. So we actually, this year we've gotten so much rain. But the past couple of years we've been in some pretty severe drought. And I was actually just on a call this morning talking about some programming that our extension folks want to do about diversifying water sources, so that the next time, there probably will be a next time that we're in a drought up here again.
Yeah.
What dairy farmers can do to kind of protect that that water availability. So can we talk about water issues a little bit? Is that fine?
Yeah, we can. You know, obviously that is something in the Southwest that is at the forefront of our mind always. I mean, it is literally our limiting resource. Conversations mm-hmm. about the future of dairy in Eastern New Mexico, and I would say West Texas, revolve around what our water source looks like. You know, we obviously here have a lot of center pivots. So I think a lot of people are under maybe the impression that like, oh, you will there solve the problem, right? Doesn't matter if you have a drought or not. But we are on the very edge of the Ogallala Aquifer. And so with every year of decreasing size of that aquifer, especially where we're at, you know, if you think about the Ogallala Aquifer in Nebraska, it is a very different, while it's the same aquifer, mm-hmm. it is a very different picture than us down here in the South. But we're seeing a receding of our aquifer. And so we are just at a point where we're just abandoning more and more pivots and converting back to dryland farming. And, you know, the challenges that presents, obviously, for running a dairy, not only from a feed supply, but actually from a water, you know, supply to the actual dairy as well. And so that is one of the things that dairies in New Mexico are regulated on. They have a permitted amount of water and average gallons per day they're allowed to use on their dairy. They have meters that track that, and that gets submitted to the state. that is in addition to your water rights. So if you're not familiar, you know, with the Westin water rights, that's one side of it. But then also we have like the actual permitting regulatory side of how much water we can use inside of our barns as well.
Would you happen to know, maybe I should know the answer to this. If you don't know, that's fine. How many cows are on that aquifer? Because you got West Texas, Eastern New Mexico, you got Western Kansas.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you're talking huge numbers. If you are just looking at dairy cows, you're talking huge numbers. If you're looking at beef cows, I mean, Hereford is considered the beef capital of the world. Like, that's their claim to fame. I mean, you're talking, you've got a lot of head of cattle. When people think of dairying, I feel like they don't often always think of like New Mexico and even Texas. And I feel like our milk shed here in Eastern New Mexico and West Texas, if we were a single state, I mean, it would be, our footprint would be massive. But with that center line down the middle of us dividing it into two states, I feel like sometimes that impact isn't always as like pronounced or as known, just because we are split up between those two states. And then, you know, obviously East Texas looks very different than the West Texas dairy farming scenario. But yeah, you're talking, you know, just dairy cows. And then if you looked at beef cows, I mean, huge, huge numbers are going on here.
So what does that process of look like of kind of determining what a dairy's water footprint is, and then deciding what they can do to reduce that water footprint?
Yeah. So, you know, through your permitting process, you are kind of figuring out how many gallons you think you're going to use, like per cow per day is kind of how you break it down. That was one of our metrics we looked at, because it was an easy comparison to be able to see, like, okay, because obviously different size dairies are going to use different amounts of water, and it can be a drastic difference. But when you break it down per cow number, it gives you a better picture of like, oh, this dairy is doing really well, or this dairy we could use improvements or whatever. That was kind of the metric we were able to look at. And a lot of times, you know, I always joke that when we think of sustainability, we think of these big, huge projects, these multi-million dollar projects like digesters and, you know, all these things you kind of see that make the news. And from a water use standpoint, it honestly was the simplest little management changes that had the biggest impact. If you have leaking hoses in your barn, you're going to see a huge, you know, water number in your meter. If you, you know, just are having hoses running, you're going to see a lot of water being used. So sometimes it was as simple as putting nozzles on hoses, timers on hoses, all of those things, and you could see a drastic cut. From there, you know, you get into different, you know, ways of cooling, like chilling your milk, how your chiller is ran, all of those kind of things then play even more in reducing that barn water use. There's not a whole lot you can do, obviously, about cow drinking water. It gets pretty hot here. We want those cows drinking lots of water, but it was more on the inside of the barn, and then figuring out how to recycle that water as many times as possible in the barn before it ultimately goes out to the crops. So just kind of like maximizing water in those ways, I feel like, was a big focus of really helping our clients, you know, get below the numbers they needed to be at.
Gotcha. And that's probably got a cost savings associated with it too, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you just think about it from simply that you don't have to pump that water out of the ground, you're not paying for that electricity, you're not paying to deal with that water on the back end of the dairy. I think sometimes those costs don't always get like accounted for, of like what it takes for you to run that water through a separator. It goes into a lagoon, then you have to run it through a pipe out onto the field. And then not even looking at, you know, just the, you know, sustainability piece, that the more water you can leave in the ground, the better. And so there is a lot of factors that go into play there with the cost savings as well.
So if we can pivot back to kind of your podcaster hat your consumer forward hat, is this a big issue that you're talking, is that concerns a lot of people? Is that water use going to be a big concern for a lot of people? Or what would you say are people's main objections to dairy farming when you're talking to the consumer?
Yeah, I think overall, it's not even just like broken down into dairy. I feel like a lot of times we think about ag all very like segregated, right? Like you have dairy, you have beef cows. I find more often than not that consumers, if they even think about ag at all, that's terrible to say, but they just think of us as kind of like one giant unit, right? Like we are ag. And then there is obviously some difference, I would say, in like animal ag, that a lot of times there's a blanket statement that, you know, like animal ag is bad for the planet. Like those kind of like misconceptions and notions are out there. I will say, though, out west, we are seeing more conversation around water use. I have spoken in Utah. We've done some articles that we've covered on the podcast about water use in Arizona. And there is, I mean, as water gets more and more as a limiting resource out here, obviously there's going to be more and more conversations, very heated conversations about who is using water and how much of it. And I think that we are seeing that really in the forefront. You know, there's been a lot of conversation about how much alfalfa uses and where that alfalfa is ending up. That was a big topic we covered on the podcast, was the fact that for a lot, you know, there's a big farm in Arizona and a lot of the alfalfa is being sent to the Middle East. And so people, you know, the big headlines was kind of like, we're exporting our water to the Middle East. Like, should we be doing that? And that has been kind of interesting to follow, because I think it is the most I've seen of a consumer forward, I don't want to say like campaign, but just like where it is kind of in their realm of like what they're thinking about is how much water are things using, and where, you know, where are those foods or those feed stuffs ending up?
Yeah. So this is something that I don't know if I think about it a lot, but I do think about this sometimes. So you just kind of laid out a very nuanced issue, right? And kind of like dove into some things that I haven't thought about, right? Like, and I'm very pro ag, obviously. So when you are talking to the consumer, we have a tendency to want to justify everything that we do, right? Like that's, I think a lot of times our knee-jerk reaction is, oh, this is like everything we do is fine. But we know that we're moving forward. We know that we have challenges in the industry. We know what the industry looks like 20 years from now isn't going to be what it looks like right now. If it does look like it does right now, 20 years from now, we're probably out of business, right?
Right.
So we're always trying to have that forward progress. But at the same time, we do what we do for a reason. So how do you have that conversation in a way that people can sit and listen to it, right? Because there's so much to unpack there. And if you don't even understand, if you haven't even wrapped your mind around the differences between like the dairy and the beef industry, and then to kind of get into some very nuanced issues, it can be a lot for people to digest. So how do you hold those two things in at the same time?
Yes, there's so many different factors at play. I feel like one of the things both Natalie's my co-host on Discover Ag, you know, we talk about a lot of times with consumers, like this is a nuanced conversation. Like consumers do tend to want things to be black and white. They want them to be like packaged in a little box and like, you know, you check yes or no. And you could apply that to so many things. You know, they want to be like, oh, this farm is regenerative. Yep, it's check the box, it's regenerative. And we'll have to explain like, you know, being regenerative is like on a scale, is on a spectrum, that you can have different practices all along that spectrum of how, you know, quote unquote regenerative you're being. And lots of conventional production ag, the traditional production ag, are maybe doing more, you know, regenerative ag things than you think. At the same time, like even like we talk a lot about labels, like that, you know, consumers want to see a label. And it's like that label might not even mean anything, or it might not mean what you think it means. There's so much nuance to this conversation. And so I think that's one of the things to establish with consumers is like, this is not as simple as you think it is. All of ag is interconnected in so many ways. I mean, we know that with dairies, right? Like you think about that dairies, cows consume cottonseed, and like that's a byproduct of making cotton. That has nothing to do with animal ag, and yet it plays a part in our animal ag production. And you can name a million scenarios exactly like that. And so discussing that nuance, another piece of it for me is bringing it to the consumer in the way that they want it. Our podcast, we joke that it is just as entertaining as it is informative, and we try to have a lot of fun with it. We talk, you know, we bring in pop culture references, we bring in, you know, Western culture influence, and then we bring in agriculture. And so maybe from the outside, you're like, you guys don't even talk about production ag that much. But I promise you, if we sat down every week for an hour and just like straight talked production ag, I don't know how many consumers we'd actually end up getting to listen to the show, let alone like take anything away from it. And so we have to like kind of meet consumers where they're at to have these conversations, you know, like bring them into the fold of agriculture, bring them into food, without like getting too lost in the weeds with them. And I know that's almost like an oxymoron, because I said it's really nuanced and there's so much detail, but like it is striking that balance of like giving them information, but not overloading them with information either.
I was quickly trying to see if I could find it in this book while you were chatting. I recommend this book all the time. It's called Think Again by Adam Grant. And we're not sponsored or anything like that. This is just one of my favorites, but he has a whole section in this book about how, when people are communicating about research, about nuanced issues, they're actually found more trustworthy if they show that there's nuance to the issue. So people are more willing to be persuaded by your discussion of something when you can say like, yeah, this actually has nuance, right? Like this is, there's kind of different facets of this. It can be, and I think when we're talking as people who are kind of in this world all the time, you know, it's very easy for us to assume a level of understanding that not everybody has. And so I think that can be kind of part of it too, right? Is that, yeah, we appreciate the nuance. And then down at, and this is probably what you're saying too, down at the a more basic level, you can appreciate that there's nuance, but you're not even speaking the same language that I'm speaking right now. So we have to kind of set that language at the same time. And I love some of the things that you mentioned in there, like entertainment, right? And I think those are things that I even use in my class too, right? You have to keep people engaged. You have to keep people interested. You know, just somebody standing up there reading facts at you isn't necessarily going to be persuasive, right? So it's going to be a lot of work. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I would say that is true. You know, I think one of the things that happened is this wasn't like something that just happened overnight, right? Like there was a transition in, I would say, the last, you know, as we know, 100 years of people being more removed from agriculture. You know, first it was one generation, you know, that people were kind of removed. So maybe as farmers, we didn't realize how much we needed to be talking about it in that moment. And then we got another generation removed. And now that we're three or four generations, now we're sitting down as ag saying, oh, wow, we have a problem and we need to go back and start telling people about agriculture. And one of the things I talk about in my keynote speech is we are now trying to catch people up about 100 years. Mm. And we're surprised when they're shocked by the technology. You know, as a dairy farmer, I have had conversations with people close to me, very educated people who thought we still milk cows by hand.
Yeah.
If that is where our consumer genuinely is at, maybe not every consumer, but you can get the general sentiment of where our consumers are at. And we're trying to catch them all the way up to the technology we're using on farms, whether that's robotics, carousel milking, GMOs, like you name it. We are trying to catch them up. That is a huge knowledge gap that we're trying to fill. And in what gets filled, especially with the internet, is misinformation, right? You see one video about something, you see, you know, something trending on TikTok or whatever. And that gap is just, it's going to be filled with something. And so we have to do a better job and accept, I think, some responsibility as farmers that this is now part of our job, is to make sure we're bringing our customers and consumers along with us on this like development of agriculture. Because I mean, and a lot of times I say to them, like, you're not running your business the same way the three generations back did it. Why should it be the same for agriculture? Like, I think we can all, probably all agree for the most part in ag, we are in the best place we've ever been. How are we not communicating that better to consumers that they actually think our technology makes us worse? I mean, how many times have we kind of seen like the old McDonald, you know, theme of like consumers wanting us to go back to that? And it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Yeah. Animal welfare was not necessarily better. Farmer welfare was not better. Like the list goes on and on of things that we have improved on and are in a better place now. And we have to figure out how to bring them along with us and have them understand that.
Yeah, absolutely. Rock on. I think you and I came of age around the same time. I graduated undergrad in 2010.
2011. Yep.
So we're in undergrad, you know, right around that time that Facebook, Twitter, some of this social media stuff starts to take off. And we got, maybe, I don't know about you guys, but we got advocacy pushed on us quite a bit, right? Like being advocates for agriculture.
Yep, big time. Yep. Tell your story. I remember multiple times in my life thinking, if I get told that one more time, I'm going to walk out of this meeting.
And you obviously are doing a lot of this advocacy, whatever you want to call it. Do you feel like, I feel like in early days, and maybe still a little bit, but in those, you know, early social media times, we did a lot of straw manning, right? Where our takedowns were of PETA, right? Like we're kind of tailoring all of our arguments to an extreme view, right? Instead of like the normal consumer. And I still see people do that on Facebook and on social media quite a bit, where what we're arguing against is kind of the outliers and not the people in the middle. Am I wrong on saying that? Do you see that sometimes? And what do you think the difference is in the approach between trying to get the big cluster in the middle versus arguing on the extremes.
Yeah, I feel like there's two things to that. I agree that I think that it is very easy to get like wrapped up in what the loudest voices are like. Mm-hmm. And I think so one of the things you have to remember is you like it's my co-host describes it as like it's a hamburger, right? You have your bun on one end of the people that will never, ever support you. A small, thin, you know, bun that's on one side. You have the other end of the bun that is also a small piece that people are like diehard, right? They're in ag. We all love each other. We're all going to support each other. Then you have like the meat of it in the middle and like it's the movable middle. Mm-hmm. Those are the people you actually want to reach. And a lot of times they are the silent like majority. I feel like that word has been thrown around a lot, but those aren't the people that are yelling and screaming on Facebook, right? Like they're just like quietly observing things. And I think when you start sharing on social media, you can really easy end up with an algorithm that is just like feeding you
yes.
like extreme content. As we know, like this applies to lots of other things besides just food. And you can see that and think, oh my gosh, every person in the world like hates dairy. And like, you feel like you have to be like screaming back. And in reality, it is like such a small amount of people. And then the other thing that's important to remember is, you know, extreme content goes viral online. Like that's what the algorithm's looking for is viral content. And so like just remembering to keep like true to your voice, true to your message of where you started and not get too like down in the rabbit holes of like the extremist. Cause I agree, as a yelling at PETA is never ever going to really like change a consumer's mind. We're never going to change PETA's mind. I also think we're getting like smarter consumers online. Like it has been, you know what, 13 years now since our undergrad years that consumers are becoming maybe a little bit more like vigilant of like what they're consuming, what's happening. I mean, I was at a meeting recently where they said that PETA has more negative mentions online than like almost any like brand out there. Yeah. Like it's unbelievable the percentage of when you mention PETA, like it's negative online.
Yep.
And so like just like kind of like remembering that messaging doesn't necessarily, just because you're seeing it doesn't mean it's hitting well with people. And I also think the last thing I'll say about it is I feel like I have tried to frame my mind around being on the offense instead of the defense. I think so many times, especially dairy farmers, probably all of ag, but we're in dairy, so this is what I'm seeing. We will react so strongly to something and like blow up about something. And it's like, that's not the time to be reacting. Like we should have been having a strategy of being on the offense for months, years, you know, leading up to things instead of just reacting to whatever. And I think that is a really crucial piece, because when you come off on the defense, it just we've probably all heard, like I've heard the sentiment like big dairy, you know, like the big dairies coming in. And I think when we play the defense, it plays into that persona that activists like often paint for dairy online. And if we're on the offense, it's not. It can come across more as like the individual stories of dairy farm families. And it is more that message that gets put out there.
Yeah. I think I've had the conversation with a couple older folks before.
We'll say that quietly.
You don't have to correct everything that's wrong on the internet, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
That's going to not be a good use of your time, first of all, because you're not going to convince the people that are, you're not going to convince certain folks like you said. But I also appreciate that you brought up that algorithm, and it really does drive things that are reactive.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you see something that's like, ugh, like hate that and reply to it, the algorithm knows it engaged and it'll start feeding you more and more of that content. And I think that that's, you know, probably says is probably the root cause of a lot of issues, not just in agriculture, but other things in our country right now. So
One note on that, it is kind of crazy. I talk about this in my keynote speech as well, is that there was a study just recently that came out, and it was about, it looked at like all the content on Twitter, and viral content on Twitter was, or X, previously known as Twitter, was more likely to be false. Like it was more likely to go viral if it was not even accurate information. And whether that is exactly what you're saying, like people are like, that's not true. And they're reacting to it. And that pushes it out in the algorithm, or just like, you know, that fighting. And so that is something to like kind of remember, is like, if you do have content creators that are trying to push content, they're going to make it the most like controversial, clickbait, you know, hook headline as they possibly can. And then you have to remember, like, not all of that even is going to be true. So it's a wild world we live in the online space.
Well, we're coming towards the end of our time. So we're going to ask you our three questions. Well, we're going to ad lib three questions because this is your second time as a guest. So we're going to ad lib three questions.
It's time for our famous three.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Our Yeast 40 Ruminal and Intestinal Double Modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Feed solutions that surpass expectations. Learn more about the benefits of working with Schooler. Visit schooler.com/feed. That's schooler.com/feed. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Your partner for extra animal performance, Berg & Schmidt Animal Nutrition.
Modern solutions for modern cows with AHV. Contact us to beat biofilm-related issues in your herd. Modern bacteria create biofilms, and biofilm-related issues are at the core of most culling reasons on modern dairy farms. AHV provides the only program for biofilm management in cows and calves. How much of your herd's potential gets choked out by biofilm each year? To learn more, visit www.ahvint.com/US.
Very good. All right. So our three questions, your three questions, your special three questions. The first one I'm going to ask you is going to be the same one that we ask all the time. And that's, what's your favorite related, favorite dairy related book or resource besides Discover Ag?
Yeah. Gosh, that's so hard. I don't know that I have one. I feel like one of the things, especially with Discover Ag, I try to consume a lot of news. Like, I never would have guessed in my undergrad years that I would consume as much news as I do now. But I subscribe to a lot of newsletters, whether that be co-ops ones. I love some of the checkoff ones. I just love those newsletters that'll add. There's one that there's like a protein pack one that is kind of all of animal ag. There's like a Global Meat Alliance. Like, there, I just subscribe to a bunch of these, and it's just nice. I feel like a few times a week they end up in my inbox and are like the breakdown of everything that's kind of going on in our industry. And so it's not just like one source, but just you're seeing like kind of the array of things that are going on in the dairy industry. So I do really love some of those newsletters.
All right. My second question, since you're obviously a podcast fan, what is your favorite non-ag podcast?
Oh my gosh. I don't know if this will hit with your audience, but I am obsessed with Giggly Squad. It is definitely non-ag. It is two women comedians. It is a very women-focused podcast. I've made my husband listen to it, and he's like, I don't get it. It's not funny. I don't understand. And I'm like, it's not for you, honey. I promise you that. But it is quite hysterical. If you are looking for some like adult women humor, like, it is just very, very on. There's so many other really good ones, but that's the one that comes to mind today, as their new episodes usually drop on Monday. So it's at top of mind for me right now.
All right. And our last question, normally say what sets a successful dairy professional apart from those that aren't successful, but I'm curious, what does it take to be a podcaster?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think that there is a misconception that podcasting is very like easy and doesn't take a lot of time. And it's not that way you do it. You know, podcasting is not necessarily hard. Like, it's not physical labor, right? Like, you're inside talking in a mic. But there's just a lot more on the back end, I think, than people realize. We are very much, I think, in the age. It reminds me of, you know, 10 years ago when everyone was getting on Instagram, and now everyone is starting a podcast. And I know of a lot of people who have started and kind of dropped off, unfortunately, but I do think people get into it and then they're like, whoa, the back end, like, you can put out something, but if you can't get it out to people, promote it, all of that stuff, you know, that's what takes the time, is like just the back end that nobody sees of the podcasting world. And so that I would say, like, if you decide to do it, like, go all in on it. It's the best place to be. It's the best space to hang out. I love the long form content. But be ready to, like, you know, put in some time and some work, because there's just more to it than people realize.
Unless you're lucky enough like me and have a Wise Medics podcast. And I'm very lucky to have folks that do all that back end stuff. So all I have to do is hop online and chat with very interesting people like yourself.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me on today. I loved this chat, so thank you.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent with APA Time Zone Hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.